Hey folks, Rob Wolf here with a whole gaggle of paleo kind of oriented folks. We've got Dr. Boyd Eaton. We've got Charles Mayfield of Paleo Comforts Food fame. And we have the ever large and in charge, Greg Everett. How's everybody doing?
Fantastic.
A-okay.
Awesome, Doc. Charles, how so you guys got to watch some iCaveman last night?
We did. I actually took a John up the road to Marietta, Georgia, and joined Mr. Billy Berger at his house to watch the first half. And you'd have been proud, man. He had cave drawings up on the walls throughout his house. It was something else.
Billy is the real deal, man. It's so funny when we did the casting for that. It's in L.A. and there's a bunch of people in this room, and this one, they called somebody, and this big dude stands up. Like, Billy's probably 6'2", 240, 250 pounds, big jacked guy. And I was like, I really hope that guy doesn't make it, because I don't know how I'm going to feed my little scrawny self, let alone him. But he's been studying primitive skill stuff since he was 7 years old. He's just amazing with it.
Well, that's the kind of guy that you need, for sure, on a trip like that.
He saved our bacon, and as a fallback, we figured, worst-case scenario, Donner Party kind of gig, he would probably keep the rest of us fed for a little while. That was the ulterior plan.
Hey, little cannibalism, is that what you're talking about?
Possibly, yeah. Maybe the Donner story isn't as popular on the East Coast. It's a pretty big deal here on the West Coast, so yeah.
We East Coasters are more civilized.
That is absolutely true. You'll never hear me argue about that. So, Boyd, I don't know if, a lot of folks are familiar at this point with your work. You authored this original groundbreaking paper in the New England Journal of Medicine. You wrote the Paleolithic Prescription. But, Boyd, just tell folks a little bit about your background. Like, you're a medical doctor. You're there at Emory. What type of undergrad did you do? What's your specialty in medicine? Just give folks a little bit of background with you.
I'm a radiologist, and my specialty is radiology. We do basically sports radiology with the professional teams here in Atlanta, with the college teams, and mostly, of course, with weekend warriors. So I'm very involved in that kind of thing. So I know a lot of orthopedists and a lot of folks who work with sports-related injuries. And, of course, injuries coming from falling over the back wall and that sort of thing. As far as my own background, all my life I have been immensely interested in anthropology and paleontology and history, and that remained just a background amateur-type interest until I turned 40, and at that point I began to think about health promotion and disease prevention as things that really applied to me and weren't just foreign areas. And after thinking about it and reading over the recommendations of people in health promotion and disease prevention, it occurred to me that what they were recommending was really a latter-day description of the lives experienced by hunter-gatherers, which in turn are today's version of what our ancestors lived like. And then finally, of course, it occurred to me that the reason that the two were so similar is because the way our ancestors lived is really the healthiest way for us to live now.
Now, Doc, I mean, you're singing to the choir on all of that, but why? Why is this hunter-gatherer framework, why is the way that our hunter-gatherer ancestors lived so important for us from a health promotion standpoint? Like, why is it healthy for us?
Rob, we may be singing to the choir now, but in 1985, the choir was a whole heck of a lot smaller. It's bigger now because people like yourself have made it bigger, and I've got to congratulate you and thank you for doing exactly what you're doing, because that has made a tremendous impact, and a lot more so than what we did. Well, the answer to your question, though, is that genetically, in essentially all the important ways, we remain Stone Agers. Now, we're talking over Skype here. We're sitting in a pleasant environment, and we think of ourselves as being civilized, cultured, 21st century people, but our bodies in ever so many important ways remain bodies of Stone Agers. And when you have any health situation, you're going to do better when your body and your lifestyle matches up with the way for which your genes were originally selected. And that's why emulating the essential features of ancestral living is beneficial for health in the present day.
So Doc, when you arrived at this, in part just kind of a synthesis of your background in anthropology and study of history, but then also looking at what seemed to be the more beneficial elements of health promotion. But was that kind of synthesis, or what? You know, I've talked to Lauren about this stuff. He just kind of had this idea, and I believe it was after reading your paper about this, you know, evolution via natural selection applied to medicine, basically evolutionary medicine. I mean, was it like just an aha moment for you, or did you kind of sneak up on this thing and then suddenly you were kind of like, wow, okay, this really seems to describe everything that we need here?
Rob, I think that a lot of aha moments come through a combination of what you're talking about. You read about things, you think about them, you let them percolate in your mind, and all of a sudden an aha moment comes. But it just doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes because you've been rolling around these things in your mind for some period of time, and then all of a sudden something, a light bulb goes on, and you realize that what health promotion folks are doing is reinventing the wheel. They're reassembling the essential elements of ancestral living. Take diabetes, for example, or take this obesity epidemic that we have. The reason obesity is so important is because it changes the body composition, our body composition, so we are unlike any free living animals, mammals anywhere else in on Earth. We have way too much fat and way too little muscle, and that means that any time an insulin molecule is released from the pancreas, it doesn't produce as much impact. It doesn't have the physiological or biochemical effect that it should have. It has only a partial effect because so much of it is being used inefficiently by going to fat as opposed to muscle.
So it's just this whole change in kind of the hormonal milieu and our activity and the whole thing that plays into this. Doc, what was the main influence for you? Can you think of like a particular book, a particular paper that you would say really directed you down this course, particularly with directing you towards writing that original New England Journal of Medical paper?
Probably it was going to a conference which was held in California in 1984. And these were people who were paleontologists for the most part and some anthropologists. And the whole focus was on the history of human food. What did our ancestors consume? What was the ancestral diet? And as they talked, some of them were looking at bony remains and getting information from that. Some of them were doing studies of hunters and gatherers and drawing inferences from that. And as I listened to this ongoing conference with many of the most famous anthropologists and paleontologists in the world, it was a very small conference, fewer than 50 people altogether. And that, I think, was probably the initiating factor that really got me thinking about this. And that was a conference in March or April of 1984, and it was in February of 1985 that we published our New England Journal article.
And did you collect? Were those folks that you collaborated with on the article?
Oh, yes. Mel Connor is an anthropologist and now also a physician. He has a dual training and is a tremendous writer, just a wonderful human being. And he and I worked on this paper, and I had written much of it before and had it rejected. And Mel did some marvelous improvements in the paper, and sure enough, it got accepted by the New England Journal.
Awesome. Awesome. Doc, I don't think that people maybe are aware, but you're actually Lauren Corbain's mentor in all this stuff. Like, how did all that come about? When did Lauren contact you?
He got in touch with us after he looked at our paper in the New England Journal. He called me while I was at work one day, and frankly, a whole lot of people had been calling, and most of the calls were from people who were very nice and so forth, but didn't seem to me to have a whole lot of a whole lot to offer. But I talked with Lauren, I realized, first of all, here's a person who's very smart. Here's a person who's very enthusiastic. Here's a person who's very motivated and just a heck of a nice person, as best you could tell over the phone. And I became pleased to go on, you know, working with him. And he subsequently invited me to come to Colorado State in Fort Collins and speak to some of his classes there, and I was happy to do so. Got to meet him in person and have had interesting interactions with him ever since. I arranged for him to come with us to Greece to the International Olympic Academy, which is in ancient Olympia, and we participated in a symposium there, and we've just had a lot of very entertaining and I think very it's very uplifting times together. I think I have learned a lot from him. He's made tremendous contributions, and he's learned a little from me anyway too. It's been a good interaction.
It sure seems like it. Well, I owe it. Lauren's a close personal friend. Credit him as definitely being my mentor. And had he not done what he did, I would not be doing anything that I am doing. If you didn't do what you did, he wouldn't be doing anything either. So I, by extension, I owe you a huge debt of gratitude. Like all of the work that I'm doing is largely standing on your shoulders and his shoulders, and then the people who have come into this evolutionary medicine scene of late. So I huge thank you for everything that you've done. And it was such a huge treat to meet you at the Ancestral Health Symposium. But I've got to tell you, I was pretty nervous about the whole thing. You had a kind of rock star status in my whole estimation. And I was nervous about talking to you about some of the shift that I've been driving towards, which is a big focus on sustainability and permaculture and stuff like that. But was really surprised that that seemed to be a big part of what you're thinking about now. That was a significant part of your talk. How have you come to that? Like, I thought that I might be out kind of in the wilderness thinking about that, but then it was kind of affirming that you're thinking about this sustainability and permaculture also. Like, why did you arrive at that spot too?
First, I'd like to address what you said about thanking me. I think that the shoe is on the wrong foot there. I thank people like yourself and Charles here for popularizing this approach. And I think that the work I have done has been too indigestible for the regular public for the most part. And what you guys have done is make it into a format that the regular public can really appreciate and benefit from. And of course, that's what we should all be primarily interested in, is how can we help improve the health not only of Americans, but these problems are now extending all over the world. So please accept my thanks, you and Charles and the people like you who have done so much to popularize these ideas and to extend them to folks all across this country and in other countries as well. With regard to the main thrust of your question, a lot of my interest recently have been on problems that I foresee for my grandchildren. I'm 73 now, and my grandchildren are coming along, six of them, and I feel a certain sense of responsibility for the world in the future. And sustainability is certainly one of it. I think we have perhaps overpopulation is a problem. I think that women's rights is an issue that doesn't receive enough attention. I think that environmentalism, I think that extinction of so many species that is going on right now, all these things are major concerns for me, and they should be concerns for everyone. People talk about global warming and environmental changes and so forth. We have to do something. My generation has to get going on this. Your generation has particularly to get going on this. And then the generation coming along, my grandchildren, have to work their butts off to avoid some of these problems that could have a very disastrous impact on certainly on the way we live, and possibly on the fact that it could even be bad enough to wipe us out. But you certainly would, you can look forward to something similar to the Dark Ages coming on at the end of classical civilization.
And to me, the irony in so much of this is yet again, you know, obviously we can bring some technology to bear on a lot of these problems, but we still need that kind of ancestral evolutionary biology orientation to figure out how we're going to make this system work and keep it going. Like we're the technology is cool, but you still have the dynamicism of this whole biosphere that we need to figure out how to make all that stuff work. And we're not going to figure out something that you know just qualitatively changes all that. It's still going to require looking back at the you know how these systems-based things have emerged and then still pull all that together to make it work in the future.
Well, I tell you what, that's exactly what I have been doing. I have got a book that's pretty well done, but it probably needs the writing style that you've got to change it from being too academic and that sort of thing and more reader friendly, and sometime in the future maybe we can talk about how that might you could might participate in this project. But the issue is very important, and in my opinion you're absolutely right that understanding our mind's development, we can think about how our bodies are the result of genetic factors that were selected in the past, but to a very interesting extent, our minds are the same way, that they have the genes that are involved in the formation of our minds also were selected for ancestral circumstances, and what we need to do is to tease those out, bring them into play, and make aim. Here comes a fire truck, and aim at recreating some of those circumstances for which we're mentally attuned, just as we have all been working on recreating the physical circumstances to which our bodies are attuned.
And you know, you covered a lot of material in the Paleolithic prescription, talking about the social elements of hunter-gatherer existence and whatnot, and possessions and yeah, hello.
So we hear yeah, start that one last one over again.
Yeah, we lost you for a minute there.
So much of the material that you covered in the Paleolithic prescription talks about, you know, the social elements of the hunter-gatherer existence, which it, as you point out, it's all an outgrowth of our genetic heritage, and it's interesting that without understanding that background, we're a little bit lost trying to fix a lot of these problems. You know, like, do people need more stuff? Do people need to spend more time working, or do they need a quality, challenging interaction? Do they need a social support and stuff like that? And when we start looking at this from an ancestral perspective, a lot of the solutions start playing themselves out, whether or not people will actually adopt it or we figure out a way to implement it on a larger scale, we'll kind of see. But without at least that orientation, we don't really have much of a chance of fixing these things.
Well, certainly what we've tried to this point hasn't worked. And I think that you and I are on exactly the same wavelength, that we need to understand where we come from mental health-wise and how that understanding could influence the way we approach the problems that we all can recognize, but which no one so far has been able to address in an effective way.
Well, that's going to be the interesting next step to see what we can pull together on this. Doc, what on just kind of the medical side of things, what are some of the most surprising things that you've seen pop up in this paleo diet evolutionary medicine area? Like what are some things that you would have just never suspected, or what are the most surprising findings that you could think of, or maybe some of the surprising things out of the Ancestral Health Symposium that you took in?
Well, I'm not sure it was necessarily surprising, but it was certainly pleasing to see the health status of the folks who came to the Ancestral Health Symposium. There were 500 or 600 people there, and they were the healthiest looking bunch at a meeting that I've ever attended. People were slender, they were athletic, they just looked like what human beings should look like, at least in my opinion. When I attend radiology meetings, there are some people like that, but there are a whole lot of people who look like regular obese, unfit Americans. And it made me feel really great that these people looked so good, because I think when people look healthy and vigorous on the outside, chances are that they're fending off chronic illnesses in a very effective way. Now, there can be some surprises, but on the whole, the chances of getting metabolic illness, the chances of getting heart disease, even the chances of getting cancer are substantially reduced by following this Paleolithic health approach. And the way people looked, I'm sitting here with Charles, and for your viewers or listeners or whatever that is an example of this sort of thing. He's looks the way people should look, lean, mean, not mean, but lean and healthy. I suppose he could be mean too if he had to be.
He is a strapping hunk of man. There is absolutely no doubt about that.
That's great. That's for your listeners or viewers who don't know you. I mean, you look like you're perfectly fit yourself, very much so. And I'm impressed with your own personal story of having gone through a kind of illness that you were able to completely erase by the health strategy that you now follow.
Yeah, I honestly doubt if I would have lived to the age of 40. You know, I'm 39 and feel pretty darn fit and healthy, all things considered. And given the problems that I had in my early 20s, early to mid-20s, before I tracked down Lauren Cordain's work and Art Devaney's work and changed the way that I eat and the way that I live, I had ulcerative colitis and things so bad that they were looking at doing a number of different surgeries on me, bowel resection being at the top of the list. And I was sick enough that I really think that, you know, somewhere along the line, whether it would have been a heart attack, whether it would have been an autoimmune disease, if I wasn't dead by 40, had I continued down that path, I would have been very, very unhealthy. I would not be in the state I'm in today. There's no doubt about that.
Well, the state you're in now looks mighty good to me, at least from what you can tell from meeting and talking and being with you for a while. The long-term situation for people who are treated by conventional means and who have ulcerative colitis or various other kinds of inflammatory bowel disease is not good. People lose weight, they're subject to infectious conditions because of their poor overall health. And cancer is a pretty common result as well. That chronic, as you probably are aware, chronic inflammation seems to be one of the inciting causes for cancers of various sorts. And certainly inflammatory bowel disease is a chronic inflammation that, that tends to lead to cancer in many cases.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Doc, if you had a limitless budget, just, you know, deepest pockets you could imagine, where would you steer current research? Like, what's a research project you would love to see happen right now?
I would love to fund a series of symposia or meetings that included people like yourself and the various folks in your end of the spectrum, and I'd like to bring in people from the academic health promotion spectrum and put them together and let them talk things over. And then I would like to fund collaborative research between the two groups and provide funds that didn't necessarily have to come from the government and weren't politically tied in with the medicine with drugs and the industries that are important in the government, such as the dairy industry and the cereal grains industry and things like that, and like to see what kind of investigative results could come from that. That's one aspect. And the other aspect is I would like to provide more and more venues for people like yourself who are so effective in communicating with the public to get out in front of the public in a way that would allow you to make your message even more widely available than it is at present. And I think that that is a way. The research would be great for justifying the concepts that we have, and then the increased presence in the public mind that you guys could bring to bear, I think could do a great deal to improve health in this country. But as you're, I'm sure, aware, the kind of problems that the paleo approach addresses are now becoming very big problems in the developing world as well as in the Western world.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, you know, I constantly receive emails from people asking, do you have a study that proves this or proves this or proves this? And it, as you well know, you know, it's hard to put together any type of a study that really proves much of anything. But we have this opportunity with now literally millions of people tinkering with this kind of evolutionary medicine, paleo diet approach that boils down to an N equals one experiment where people try this approach, see if they look, feel, and perform better. If they do, typically they stick with things. They tend to spread that message around, and we're getting a fairly burly, robust group of people that are able to report, you know, these results. And again, it's anecdotal. We don't have statistical analysis and stuff like that, but it starts becoming pretty damn compelling on some level that there might be something to this whole scene. And the really interesting development, I have some friends at the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center, and they're putting together a pretty large scale clinical intervention that would be a metabolic ward study that would expand on what Professor Lindeberg has done and try to answer some of the little bit of niggling questions that we have still dangling out there. And we're in a spot now where I think the group is big enough that when we get ready to fund this thing, if we say, hey, would, you know, give what you can, if you can donate $1,000, donate that, if you can donate $1, donate that, and we'll be able to fund some of these studies in a crowdsource manner. And it's really, really exciting because we have, you know, some really high caliber academics that get that this thing works, but that we need to fill in some of the missing pieces to make it even more compelling on the academic side. But then all the while, the social network piece is growing and growing and growing so that, you know, we might be able to somewhat privately fund this and not deal with all the political ramifications of going to the USDA or you know, different governmental funding institutions that usually deal with the academic research. So it's a pretty exciting time.
It is an exciting time. One analogy that comes to mind is in the same vein as what you're talking about, but different, is the impact of the germ theory of disease. As you're well aware, up until probably 1950, infectious disease was the big killer all across the world, in Western countries as well as the developing countries. But it had been even more so in the past. In the 19th century, people became aware of the germ theory of disease. This didn't spread through the social network, which, of course, we didn't have then, but it did spread. And consequently, hygienic practices became widespread, which had never been that way before. And you saw the drop-off of infectious diseases substantially before antibiotics came into play. So that I like to liken the paleo health movement with regard to metabolic diseases being in some respects similar to the impact of the germ theory of disease.
It's a really good analogy, actually. It's pretty amazing. And when you look back at the medical history, you had these contentious battles of people who were pushing the germ theory, and you had the people on the other side who didn't believe in it, and they thought that not only that the people pushing this germ theory were crackpots, but that there was this remarkable antagonism going on there. That it's no different than today, but you also had such a powerful methodology that when it was brought to bear on these diseases, then they resolved so quickly. It was shocking to for people to witness, but you still had people fighting this almost obvious solution to sepsis and these different problems. And we're still kind of seeing that today. It's a really, really good analogy. Do you cover that at all in your next book?
I mentioned it in an article that is under review right now, but it's an article. What you're basically talking about is the experience of a fellow named Semmelweis, who was an Austrian physician dealing particularly with obstetrics. And at that time, puerperal sepsis was a major killer for new mothers and sometimes their children too, but particularly the mothers. And the mortality from hospitalization for pregnancy was very high. And Semmelweis said, maybe what we should do is wash our hands in between going from one patient to another. And we said, oh, no, don't worry about that. We want to have our hands be as bloody as possible because that means we're really good doctors. And they actually drove the poor fellow insane. And it was another 10 or 15 years before other physicians, Lister primarily, pointed out the same thing. And eventually surgical practice changed so that cleanliness became a big part of surgery.
Wow. And if I recall correctly, kind of a similar story with the guy who came up with the connection between a folate deficiency and neural tube defects, and he was at a pretty prominent school like Harvard or something like that, and this was when it was very much not...
Harvard's not a prominent school.
It's barely Ivy League, I'll concede you that. But if I remember the story correctly...
That's where I went to medical school.
And oh, okay.
Just
okay.
Teasing.
Awesome. Well, I figured we'd get Matt Lalonde up into a fury over that. But, it's a kind of a similar deal where it was just a very simple idea that was put out there. And because it wasn't vogue for people to assume that nutritional deficiencies could be a factor in different diseases, particularly on kind of a subtle level like that, versus like an overt deficiency where you see like pellagra or something, they pretty much ran the guy out on a rail. He ended up at like some small state school, and then about 25 years later, everybody said, "Oh, okay, actually, you were correct in that folate linkage to a neural tube defect." So it's really wacky to me that you know, whether we're talking kind of religious scenes or scientific scenes, the battle lines get drawn and deep and mean. And to some degree, that's where I've put a little bit of faith in this social network side of just trying to get people to try and try new things, report what your findings are, and then just kind of running with that. It's almost doing an end run around the establishment.
Well, I often think that what you're doing, you and your compatriots in the same field, is just exactly that. You're bypassing the more constipated side of the academia, shall we say, and reaching out to the people. And there are people, there are, of course, folks who do this for their own financial gain, and they're promoting stuff that is quackery and so forth. But having heard you speak and some of the other people speak who are involved in the social media, I've been immensely impressed that your goals and your methods are on track and worthy of respect as anything could be. I came away from that conference. Maybe that was the single most uplifting aspect of the whole thing to me, to realize that the people who are involved in the social media in advancing the Paleolithic health concept, the paleo health concept, are, I really thought you guys were first class. That you were the kind of people I would love to have doing exactly what you're doing. I couldn't ask for a better situation. I really can't.
Well, thanks. For me, it's just a huge honor to make a living doing stuff that I love and being allowed to be a geek and help people. And I just couldn't think of anything else I would rather do. Although the caveman show was pretty fun. Living out under a bush and hunting elk wasn't too bad, but this is pretty cool too.
Well, you can probably do that. I mean, inside your house and you know, move into the backyard and you know, catch rabbits and that sort of thing. I think that what you're doing is more important. You might have enjoyed what you did for a week or whatever it was, but getting out to the public is the most important thing, in my opinion. It's the most important thing you can do to keep educating people so that in turn their lives will be improved. How can anybody ask for more than that from life?
Totally. I absolutely agree. Totally agree. Well, Doc, are we going to see a reworking and re-release of the Paleolithic Prescription? Are we going to see that thing hit the bookstores again? I didn't know that you had another book in queue.
Well, the other book is very different from the Paleolithic Prescription, although I hope it has a similar effect at some point down the line, or even more important effect down the line. However, so many people have asked us to go ahead and do an updated version of the Paleolithic Prescription that we probably are going to do that, and actually, I'd like to have people like yourself be involved. I ran this by Lauren, and it's percolating in his mind now, but I would like to keep as much of the original book as is still relevant. I would like to change those portions that obviously time has shown that we need to change them to more updated versions that are based on better science than we had at that time. And then I would like to have interjected in the book a couple of paragraphs at various points from all sorts of folks. You would be a perfect example of this, that if we're talking about strength training, for example, and where that fits in, or if we're talking about aerobic exercise, or if we're talking about various kinds of food preparation. Charles and Julie would be super for that, and I would like to have a dozen or 25 places in the book where people of your caliber are making a contribution, are adding to it. I am very fortunate that I don't have to really worry too much about the any kind of financial rewards from the book, but so that we could share the any kind of any kind of money that came from it. But I think that adding those little bits and pieces here and there that enlivened it and brought it from the theoretical to the actual would be a big help for the book.
That sounds amazing, and I can guarantee you if you have a section on how to make a curry so hot that you can melt through a titanium with it, Charles and Julie are your people. They can do it.
I can crack coconuts too, Rob.
You are pretty solid at cracking coconuts.
Does he have a good speaking voice or?
Charles is a man of many, many talents. We got to travel with him through a little bit of the Caribbean, and we got to climb trees and crack coconuts and spearfish, and Charles is a pretty solid dude.
He looks pretty good, but he has to go some to keep up with his wife, who is really a good-looking lady.
Charles, similar to myself, I'm not too sure how we scored our wives, but I'm just not going to bring too much attention to it and just be grateful. So,
yeah.
I think Charles can tell you that I, too, have been very fortunate in that respect.
Yeah.
He said that your wife was pretty good-looking. That I do seem to remember that in an email, so that's cool. There's some trend here. The paleo guys are kind of schleppy, but the paleo wives are pretty hot. So I'm definitely willing to run with that. That works for me.
Yeah, that sounds like better than the other way around, for sure. Having met Lori Cordain, I'll tell you that she is a good-looking lady also.
You know, it's funny. I've talked to her on the phone probably 100, you know, like 50 or 100 times, but I have not met her yet, so... We'll have to all meet somewhere and eat curry and drink booze. So,
Rob, I'm sensing maybe a fundraising idea for our next adventure as far as funding these studies. I'm thinking a Paleolithic calendar.
Huh?
Maybe the wives of... Boy, do you think Daphne'd be on board with that?
I know there was some kind of calendar where aged women who were all sort of homely got. Was it the aged guys? What was it? It was a calendar where they had all naked men. I guess it was. They were all fat and homely, and they published a calendar that sold like hotcakes. It was someplace in England, I think. It was after the Full Monty movie came out, I believe.
You know, Charles, you've been very good at spearheading the Paleo Comfort Foods cookbook. I say we put you in charge of that effort.
Yeah, you know better than that.
Well, boy, this is episode 100 of this podcast. If you can believe it, people have actually been listening to 100 of these, and it's just been a huge honor to have you on the show. Like, you literally are one of my heroes. Lauren is pretty cool. He's both a hero and a friend, and he looks at you in the same way. So it's just a huge honor having you on the show. Is there anything else that you want to share with listeners? Anything else that you have cooking?
Well, I just think it's an honor to be associated with people like yourself who are in the trenches, really getting these concepts out to the folks. And I think what you're doing, what Charles and Julie are doing, is tremendously important, and I'd love to, in a sense, pass the torch on to folks like yourself, because I think you're going to run with it and make a real impact on the health of Americans and people all across the world.
Thank you. That definitely seems to be what we're shooting for. Well, Doc, thank you so much for having you on, and when you get closer to releasing this other book and the rewrite of the Paleolithic prescription, we'll get you back on the show so we can talk about that stuff.
Thanks, Rob. It's been a pleasure talking with you. It was a pleasure meeting you in Los Angeles.
It was a huge pleasure meeting you, too. Looking forward to it. We're supposed to be heading out to Atlanta sometime soon here, so hopefully we'll hang out with Charles and Jules and eat some of their curry.
Sounds great.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Charles, for helping on your side. And thanks, Greg, for helping to keep the boat afloat here with this thing.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
All right, guys. Talk to you soon.